bit about you, a little bit about Pakistan, something about Pakistan, and thereafter it'll be yours. After about 5 minutes, you just proceed and give you your 45 minutes, however much time you like. Then we'll do a question answer. So that's the plan. It's very simple, and you'll have a very good audience, I think, of all kinds of people. There'll be town planners, there'll be economists, there'll be various people. So it should be fun. It's quite interesting. Give people another 5 minutes to come in.
About situations, about how and when to open things up. How about where you are?
Well, here it's accelerating.
Is
And
it?
here it's now picking up, and everybody's really worried. We don't know when the peak is. They're talking about a peak possibly in August. So right now the numbers are picking up, and the rumors are flying. And the government is trying its best to grapple with the situation. It's trying to lock down different areas. But right now it's an alarming situation. Many of us are in isolation. I haven't stepped out of the house for the last 3 months now. So, it's a tough situation. And with the poor economy, with the poor situation, and the way our towns are organized, it's not an easy situation even for the government to grapple with. So let's see how it goes. But so far it's scary, very scary, I would say, very difficult.
It has been very scary too, and here it's not affecting everyone the same way. 80% of the deaths that we've had due to COVID-19 have been in what we call long-term care homes, nursing homes, among seniors who are the most vulnerable, and that has really been a tragedy.
But here it's I think the demographics, yeah, I think the older people are dying in greater proportion, but it's also hitting me. But overall, I think we've got a less death rate, lower death rate than the western side of the world. Our death rate is amounting to on average about 2%, and this is we've also checked with graveyards, etc. So it seems this data is not exactly wrong. So our death rate is about 2%, which is not high. It is not high at all. So that's pretty good. But at the same time, given medical supplies, given hospital conditions, and given the state of health in general, it's a bit worrisome. Do we have the ability to cope with it? Even if we flatten the curve, will we be able? Do we have the hospital facilities? In the whole country of 220 million people, it's conjectured, and it's not quite. I'm not quite sure. Between 1,200 to 1,400 ventilators available, out of which God knows how many are operational. So that's that's a very great shortage. Hospital beds, ICU beds, lots, all those things in short supply. Plus, it's quite expensive to go to hospital, so people are also worried about that. Government hospitals are already utilized and crowded. So let's see how it goes. But Canada, I think, is now coming out of it, huh? So that's not bad. That's very
Yes,
good.
no, the numbers are dropping significantly right across the country, and
But south of the border, is it working out or not?
it's a catastrophe. It's going the other way. It's
Mr. Trump, you never know where it's going.
and what he's doing this evening in Tulsa, Oklahoma, getting 20,000 people into an indoor space will only make things worse.
He's on another planet, I must say. But as luck would have it, he's probably going to come back. So what do
I don't
you
know. I think the world is watching in horror and
do?
fascination.
Right. We are all sort of waiting for Biden's numbers to turn up. They are turning up a little, but let's see. Summer is a long, it's a long summer. We'll find out at the end. It's a long summer. Let's see how it goes. So there it is. So anyway, another 2, 3 minutes, we'll start.
Okay.
Welcome to the PIDE webinar. This is the second or the third in our series on the cities webinars. We have got today a great speaker with us, but let me first go through a bit of housekeeping. Please make sure your mics are muted so that our speakers have the first chance to speak. later you can raise your hand, and obviously everybody has a chance to speak in our webinars. We make sure everybody has a chance. These cartoons are to remind you that we remain in the grasp of the IMF and donors. We'll leave that for today. That's not the subject for today. Just to remind you, the webinars are mainly for the academic community, and today for the urban planners. We want to speak to the thinkers of the community. We're not trying to rival the television and the public debate, which tends to be pretty bad in this country. So this is the main, our purpose is very different. So please bear that in mind. We've got today Mr. Ken Greenberg. Ken has been a city planner, chief city planner, one of the major architects of cities in North America. He's been a moving spirit in Toronto, Boston, and many other cities. He's had a long experience in cities. He's written two very important, very illuminating books, Toronto Reborn, Design Successes and Challenges, and then Walking Home, Life and Lessons of a City Builder. So I think he's contributed a huge amount to making Canadian cities the way they are. Canadian cities these days are leaders in terms of urban development. So we really need to think and learn from him. Ken has done many interesting projects he'll talk about. Most importantly, Ken, I'd like you at some point later in the topic also discuss Jane Jacobs, because he was closely associated with Jane Jacobs, is a good friend of Jane Jacobs. And Jane Jacobs at least introduced me to urbanism and many people to urbanism. And I think, Ken, through your auspices, we'd like to learn about her too, and for us to introduce Jane Jacobs to Pakistan, because few people know about her. But very briefly, before I hand it over to Ken, let me tell you what we at the PID have learned about Pakistani cities, which we would like to bear in your mind when you make your presentation. In Pakistan, we have some of the world's largest cities. Karachi is 15 plus million, Lahore is 12 to 13. You've got 20 cities above a million, more than 100, over 100,000. So you've got a large amount of cities. But as you can see from this map, we have a tendency to make a sprawl. This is the map of Faisalabad over 20 years, and we can see the way the sprawl is increasing. Pakistan is also now getting largely urbanized. Some estimates suggest 70% urbanized, although the census says less, but let's leave that as it is. City planning in Pakistan has been inspired by the Harvard Advisory Group, by donors, World Bank, etc. Foreign consultants lead that, but we have tended to follow the American suburban model. Heavily based on cars, you can see here, this is the city center in Lahore. This is the way the traffic and people and shops operate. We've got a very rigid American-style zoning where there's a deep separation between commercial centers and housing centers and various other centers, but there's a huge premium on suburb, the single family house. We want to make single family housing everywhere. Our cities, as I said, are car dependent sprawls. There's a very deep aversion to letting downtowns develop. Our downtowns look like this picture here. And this is what we do to pedestrians. They have to climb up to come down. There are no zebra crossings anywhere. We build highways within the city and cycle-free corridors. We have no premium at all to walkability. Sidewalks are rare, and as I said, you have to climb up if you want to cross the road. We also build expensive metros, which is on a platform, buses on a platform, but we don't have buses otherwise. And most importantly of all, again, you might be interested to hear, in such large cities, we have free parking anywhere. Or very nominal charge, like 5 cents, 10 cents for the whole day. So there's really no charge for parking. We also have a very interesting approach. We exclude the poor. There's no zoning for the poor at all. All our cities are zoned for the rich. In fact, apartments, apart from Karachi one city, other cities have no zoning for apartments or any poor zoning at all. There is also no place for business, especially for the poor. So street vending is almost banned. And there's informal street vending, and you can see from the picture what we do to it. We kill the street vending. Now and again, it's called an encroachment. So the poor are basically called an encroachment in our cities, and we try and beat them down as and when we can. The result is that the Prime Minister now wants to build 5 million houses. His mandate is 5 million houses. But he wants to do it through offering them subsidies and mortgages, even though they don't have jobs and even though they don't have any profile to be able to get a mortgage. So they're going to do a subsidy thing. I don't know how they're going to do it. Probably not. Probably they'll fail. But they want to build this houses outside the cities. And here you can see a picture of our shanty towns. This is how the poor live. And they live very far from their jobs. So the transport is very difficult. So we'd also like to learn from you, how do we include the poor? Then there are huge shortages everywhere. These are our sort of shopping centers. They look like this. And our schools, we don't have schools. Schools are built in houses. Offices, we don't have, they're built in houses. Shops are kind of built in houses too. Warehouses are in old townhouses. In fact, in Lahore, very old townhouses, 400-year-old townhouses, house warehouses. Young professionals have no place to go. There are no community infrastructure. There's no community centers, there's no playgrounds, nothing. Of course, with the cars, the cities are unbreathable. My city, Lahore, for example, 3-4 months in a year, it's the dirtiest city in the year, in the world. Commuting is a huge issue, and everybody's forced to commute longer and longer distances. So this is where we are. So with this, Ken, I'd like you to help us think about our cities. We are drowning in sprawl, cars, and homelessness for the poor. Please help us clarify our vision of city planning, role of cities in economy and societies. We're all very confused about it. And I'd like you to help us educate our city planners. With that, Ken, I hand the floor over to you. Please take over and start.
Nadeem, thank you very much for your introduction. I'm just going to get my screen organized here. So I am very pleased to be able to do this with you this morning. I really appreciate the opportunity. Can you all see the screen properly?
Yes.
Great. This really came about as a result I had with a Pakistani living in Toronto, Zoya Ali, who may be known to many of you. We had a really interesting conversation. And the gist of it was, even though our circumstances may be extremely different, and I think your introduction and the slides were very enlightening. I thank you for that, very helpful. There might be some things that we could talk about in terms of challenges that we share and ideas that are gestating in my part of the world that may be useful to you. I have to make a huge disclaimer, however. I have not been to Pakistan. I don't pretend other than having the most superficial knowledge. So I absolutely am relying on your end of the conversation when we end up talking about opportunities in Pakistan. I've decided to choose one way of getting into the conversation, which appeared in your presentation as well, which is the relationship to the automobile. This obviously is only one part of the larger picture of city building, but it is an extremely important one, and it has played a very powerful role in shaping our cities. So I'm calling this reflections on a paradigm shift, weaning ourselves from auto dependence. And what you see in this image is what we call the Golden Horseshoe around the eastern end, the western end of Lake Ontario. And it is a vast interconnected city region combining historic cities, but also perhaps 2/3 of the population within this area lives in auto-oriented suburbs that were created after World War II. And a lot of what I'm going to say to you has to do with our relationship with what is arguably a wonderful piece of technology, the private automobile, Henry Ford's great invention, or at least his production into the urban scene. And that the troubling relationship we have had with the car and the fact that we are now engaged in a process of transformation. So it's not letting me change the slide. Okay, so there's a moment in time which is very important. There were ideas around what the car might mean for the city that were being actively thought about and discussed in the decades, in the early decades of the 20th century as it was emerging on the scene. And in 1939, there was a World's Fair in New York, which had a very famous pavilion called the General Motors Pavilion. It was Your World of Tomorrow. There was a walking circular platform that went around the exhibit. Literally millions of people came to see this diorama, which you see in the image here. And what's interesting is that General Motors wasn't so much selling automobiles as it was really selling a way of life. It was depicting what the world could be like if we organized it around the car. Right after World War II, we had a tremendous need for housing in North America, as did Europe with the reconstruction after the war. We had returning soldiers, and this idea of building a city around the car was embraced almost euphorically. And so you see these kind of breathless images of people in that immediate aftermath of World War II, going out to see these brand new suburbs, which are depicted here. This was in all the magazines. This was really all the rage. And what it produced is a tremendous exodus from our cities into this suburban landscape. Well, it didn't take long before the defects in this started to reveal themselves. And what became this dominant paradigm actually tested to failure. So Life magazine published this cover in 1960 as Dwight Eisenhower, who was then president, was building the interstate highway system. As quickly as those highways were built, they filled up with automobiles and they became unbearably congested. Interestingly, the way he sold it to the U.S. Congress was for military purposes. He was a great admirer of the autobahns that he had seen in Germany. But what these became is the conduits for the exodus from the city out into the suburban landscapes. One thing we didn't realize immediately, but now has come back to haunt us, is the extent to which we have polluted the atmosphere and contributed to inducing climate change. Something that was really not well understood was the compromise to public health. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more, but the lifestyle that emerged when people stopped walking, as they did previously for most of the things they did in their daily lives, produced obesity, heart disease, hypertension, diabetes to much greater levels, particularly and surprisingly to people in young children who were now being driven everywhere. And then with the advent of screens, this became even more exaggerated. And of course, the need to have this tremendous dependence on fossil fuels. So this began to show up on various radar screens. And these are some images that the Board of Trade, a business-led organization in Toronto, produced, warning people about the impacts of an auto-oriented city region and the effects it would have on the economy and on business. And so in the lower left image, they show in blue a pattern of severe congestion that was already emerging. And in 2001, they estimated that there was already a $6 billion drag on the local economy. They then projected out as a kind of dire warning to 2031. And you can see the amount of blue. And they were really saying, lest we do something really significant, we are choking on automobiles. This will no longer permit us to have a successful functioning urban economy. So on the public health side, this kind of environment, and I realize this looks a little different from your world, but what may be in common is the reliance on the car. This pattern in suburbia where every adult had to have this private conveyance, this automobile, to make all the trips. Children were driven to school. At one point, it was estimated in the US that every one of these households was generating some 14 automobile trips per day, which were both taking a toll on people's lives, but also contributing to that congestion. So in 2012, the Medical Officer of Health in Toronto, picking up the public health theme, produced this map of Toronto. And what's really interesting is in the light yellow color is the historic city of Toronto, which was really developed before the automobile. As a result, it had tramways, which I saw some images of tramways in Karachi in around 1900. You had them as well. Toronto was one of the few North American cities, with possible exception of San Francisco, that did not get rid of what we call streetcars or tramways. It had historic main streets where people walked to do their shopping. It had local neighborhood schools where the kids would still walk to school. So it was a walkable city. Outside that, surrounding it in all the darker colors, were the areas that had developed post-war around that automobile paradigm. And there you can see that the Medical Officer of Health is warning that all those health issues that I mentioned are showing up in a very significant way. So where we are today, and I hope you're not all seeing this in the middle of the screen, is we are in the early, perhaps middle stages of an immense paradigm shift from that mid-20th century paradigm, which was based not only on the automobile, but the corresponding factor was the separation of where we live from where we work, from where we shop, from where we access cultural facilities. Every function of the city had its place, and you had to go from parking space to parking space to get to them. And so the paradigm shift that we are involved in now is moving to what we refer to as a more sustainable urban future, which is all around mixed use, combining living and working and shopping and schools and daycare and recreation and cultural uses in integrated neighborhoods that are walkable and compact. And so that's the urban future that we are attempting to move to. Now, here's an interesting parallel, I think, that we could talk about with the developing world. And I'm going to use the cell phone. In many parts of the world, people have gone from not having telephones to going straight to cell phones without going through the stage of having landlines. And I think what's interesting about that analogy is the extent to which it may be possible for countries in the developing world, such as yours, to make decisions not to go through all the stages of what we now regard as errors in the embrace of the automobile and land use segregation, and move directly to the more advanced stages of the paradigm shift that I'm going to talk about. And I acknowledge right away that culturally, that is not an easy thing to do. It is disturbing to me in many ways, some of the consulting firms, if I can call it from the West, are actually going and spreading in other parts of the world some of our worst practices that are out of date and inappropriate. So as Nadim mentioned, this really was the subject of my first book, which surprised me by becoming a national bestseller in Canada for nonfiction. By the way, that's not a huge number of books, before anyone gets too excited about that, but it was something of a big deal, because what it showed was that city building was not the province only of specialists or experts. This is something that the public was very engaged in and interested in. And a key component of the shift that I talk about is a reassessment of that reliance on the automobile, the technology that drove it, and its place in the urban context. So here's what happened, which was truly surprising. You've heard the expression, the American dream, or we in Canada, we like to say the North American dream. It looked like what you see on the left. This is what young people aspired to in my parents' generation, in those generations right after World War II. It was to have a house, a garden, a car, a garage, ideally, and somewhere outside the core of the city. That dream for a very significant cohort of young people has been replaced by another much more potent one, which reflects a very different set of priorities. And I can simplify it. If you look at the image on the right, it's young people now aspire to live in a place where they can walk to buy their groceries, where they can take a bicycle, and where they can take transit to work. And to tell you how significant that has become, we have vast numbers of young people who are choosing not to get a driver's license. So one of the figures that I have seen, which I found extraordinary, is that in the age cohort from 16, which is the earliest age when you can get a driver's license, to age 34, we now have 26% of that age cohort who do not have a driver's license. That is an astonishing change. When I was 16 years old, the very first thing I did, the first possible moment I could, was to get a driver's license and a secondhand car. Because I saw that as liberation, I saw that as success. So you now have the young people that you see on the right in this image who live in downtown Toronto have bragging rights if they can say, I don't own a car. If I have to use a car, if I do have a driver's license, I'm using some form of car share for occasional use of a car, but I do not have to own a private automobile. And even more significant, we've gone completely away from the time when the type of car that you owned was a signal of some kind of prestige. If you owned an expensive high-powered car with all kinds of gadgets, that was some sign of arriving in life. Now it's having a bicycle and it's living in a neighborhood where you can walk. I can't exaggerate the extent to which that is a change. And it came about not as a result of some ideological position, simply people, young people seeking convenience in their lives, not wanting to spend hours a day trapped in congested highways and automobiles making long commutes. So I don't know if you're familiar with an organization called the Urban Land Institute, the ULI. The ULI is the probably the most significant professional organization for people in the development industry. It has chapters worldwide. It has a very large chapter in the Toronto area. So in 2013, they published this report for their members. And what they were telling their members who were renting and leasing property, they were property developers, is you better pay attention to this. Your clientele has changed. What they're looking for now are these compact mixed-use neighborhoods with reliable transit and the opportunity to have things within that short distance from where they live. And in the bottom, they show the, as this proceeds from baby boomer to Gen X to Gen Y, this tendency is only increasing. So here's an interesting diagram of the paradigm shift that we're in the throes of. On the left, you see a world all built around the automobile. Up on the top, you see those individual enclaves in the city accessed by cars with parking. Often the area occupied by parking exceeds the area occupied by usable space, either in the form of surface parking lots, on-street parking, or multi-story garages. And on the right, you see the emerging paradigm that people are striving for. Yes, there are still vehicles, but pride of place is given to walking, then cycling, then transit. You can see the bike lane there. You can see different types of transit vehicles. And most importantly, when you get down to the neighborhood level, there are increasingly what we were referring to as 15 or 20 minute neighborhoods. The mayor of Paris, by the way, Anne Hidalgo, has made this the centerpiece of her administration. It's very much part of what we talk about in Canada now. The idea is that within a 20-minute walk, within roughly, let's say, an 800-meter radius, you will find most of the things that you need in the course of your daily life, or as many of those as possible. And that for all ages of the population, from young families with children to seniors to young people setting out. So here's the larger scale problem we are wrestling with in the Toronto region, in this Greater Golden Horseshoe that I was talking about. We are the fastest growing city region in North America. We also have two extraordinary characteristics which have to do with why we're growing so fast. Over 50% of our population was born in another country. We are the most diverse city region in the world, and over 50% identify as what we call visible minorities. And this is the most surprising part of that, whereas in most of the world, these cultural differences are sources of tension, are seen as problematic. People have great difficulty wrestling this with this. We only have to do, listen to the rhetoric coming out of what's happening south of the border in the US, or for that matter in many European cities. But Torontonians and Canadians, who are not smug about this, we realize this is a tremendously challenging work in progress to maintain what I'm going to say. But most Canadians and people in the Toronto region, if you ask them what they are most proud of, the first thing they will say is this diversity. Living in a world made up of so many people from so many different parts of the world who have added to the gene pool of talent, of quality, of ideas, and they are what is making us successful. And that's why we're experiencing this extraordinary growth. So by 2041, and I realize this is not, these are not large population numbers by your standards, but we're gonna grow in the region from some 6.5 million people to 13.5 million people. So the real question this poses is, where does this next generation of people coming into the region live? And this is where we're doing something quite powerful. Our provincial government, which is responsible for transportation, is making a $60 billion investment in transportation infrastructure, which is currently underway. And what you see here outlined are commuter rail lines, which we've had for some time. These commuter rail lines are being electrified. They're going from a service which was really about bringing people in peripheral bedroom dormitory suburbs, if I can put it that way, to a central business district in Toronto. And these are now going to 15-minute all-day service, which means that reverse commuting, people living downtown and working in the suburbs and vice versa, becomes very feasible. It's starting to happen already. The commuter rail is just one part of the transit investment. There is also light rail, tramways coming back as a major form of transportation. There is bus rapid transit, very important, and local bus lines, and active transportation. So it's the whole panoply of different ways of getting around. And this is the major armature for our next decades of growth in the region. So the provincial policy has identified two other things, the Green Belt, which you see here, which I believe is the largest legislated Green Belt around an urban area, absolutely enshrined in law. And then the red dots are called urban growth centers in the provincial places to grow policy. And this is where these concentrations of mixed-use neighborhoods and centers are emerging, taking advantage of the GO stations. The GO is the name of our commuter rail system, but also the light rail and the bus rapid transit. And this is a sampling. Every one of those red dots has a plan like this, which is currently underway, which is being built out. And there's an enormous range of what these are. I've had the privilege of working on several of them. I'm continuing to do so. But starting in the lower left, you have the city of Kitchener. Kitchener-Waterloo is a famous tech center now around Waterloo University. So the historic city becomes the locus or the core of this redevelopment. Brampton is the next. That is a city just to the west of Toronto, of some 650,000 people. It, by the way, has a huge South Asian population, along with many other groups. And it is the youngest and one of the fastest growing cities in Canada. It's adding 20,000 people a year. Again, by your standards, those are not big numbers. But for us, that's very significant for one of these cities. And I've been embedded as an advisor in the city of Brampton for the last year in helping them engineer this transition in their downtown and in the transformation of areas along suburban arterials. You next have the Vaughan Metropolitan Center, where the subway is actually reaching that area, and you have a whole new downtown emerging. The same is true in Richmond Hill, which is the one portrayed in the middle, in Markham Center, around a GO station and bus rapid transit. You have the same thing happening in downtown. I'm just have to move this so I can see this. Downtown Oshawa, like Kitchener, this is an historic downtown. Etobicoke Center is within the amalgamated city of Toronto. And there, a huge spaghetti junction of highways and ramps and clover leaves has been demolished to make way for a new city center in Etobicoke. Mississauga City Center, which is the neighbor to Brampton, has been anchored by a new city hall, a living arts center, a university campus, a cultural center, and is emerging as a major locus of growth. And finally, downtown Hamilton, one of our adjoining municipalities. What's fascinating is that this is a very successful collaboration of the private sector and government at several levels, all working together to engineer this transformation. You remember the ULI slide that I showed you. The developers have seen that this is where their market is heading. This is what people are looking for. It's being supported by the transit investment. So leveraging that transit investment is really the key to success. So I am co-founder of something called the City Building Institute at Ryerson University. They just put out a report, which I would really recommend to you. You can Google it easily under this title, Density Done Right. And it talks about how to do the density. It's not just the fact of the density, but how do you make these compact, walkable, sustainable 20-minute neighborhoods? How do you make them successful? And one of the major arguments is to get away from something that we have fallen into, which is tall and sprawl, a phenomenon of building either hyper-dense, very high towers, of enormous heights, and then very low density at the other end, in the two in gray, single family housing or very low housing. And the missing middle is seen as the key to success. Mid-rise buildings of a whole variety of types, different tenures, ownership and rental, serving the whole variety of the population. Also a great stress on what we call inclusionary housing, which is building in low-income housing for different income strata into all new neighborhoods that are being built. So we end up with mixed income, and we could talk further about that. This kind of density, it's not just the housing, it's getting the schools, the community centers, the daycare, the local shopping, the healthcare, all of those facilities embedded in the fabric of the neighborhood, served by transit, served by cycling, served by walkability, that really makes this successful. So it's the social development program as well as the basic development program, which is so critical. So going back to the car, What's amazing is all the ways in which we have moved away from the car and employing technology in many cases to do so. So we have all these different forms of car share that have emerged. We have bike share, and bike share is spreading like wildfire, not only in the city of Toronto, it's now a city service, but into the suburban areas which had been developed around the car. We're using our cell phones as a way of doing more efficient ticketing, getting away from the complex ways of paying for different forms of transit. An inspiration has been the Octopus system in Hong Kong. There is an organization based in Toronto. Again, I would urge you to Google them. It's called 8 to 80 Cities. And 8 to 80 Cities, and by the way, my wife, who's on this call with me, is on the board of 8 to 80 Cities. This is a nonprofit organization which works around the world. And their premise is, if you take an 8-year-old and an 80-year-old as indicator species, and you make a city where it is comfortable for them to get around on foot and on a bicycle, you have made a city that is successful for everyone. And they're applying this philosophy in cities around the world. So taking those age cohorts as key indicators, for me, I look very carefully at how kids get to school. And you can see here what happened to us. The United States, at the far end, you have only 12% who are walking or cycling to school. The others are either bused or driven. Canada falls somewhere in the middle, and this is a while ago. United Kingdom does a little better. The Scandinavian countries probably do the best of all with 75 to 80%. And so you see the kind of schoolyard scenes. I love to see all these small bicycles and the fact that those kids can walk and safely drive to school. This has become a whole movement. We have something called walking school buses. And walking school buses are where groups of kids from a neighborhood, actually with parents and with teachers, walk together to school safely as a way of getting used to the idea of getting to school that way on their own feet. And going to the other end of the age spectrum, this is from Copenhagen, and you can see seniors, a lot of white hair in that image, who have all come to enjoy an afternoon at this cafe, all on their bikes. And this is an incredibly liberating experience in the city. It is healthful. It gives people great personal mobility. It just, from an environmental standpoint, it does so many positive things. So I can't help but kind of ending talking about the impact of COVID-19. How is that affecting all of this? And what we're discovering in so many areas of our lives now is that COVID-19 is what I would call a particle accelerator. It's taking things that were happening anyway and shining a light on what works, on what doesn't work, on where we have tensions, on where we have problems, but also pushing us in terms of this paradigm shift, this transformation I've been describing, to move much more rapidly than we would have done otherwise. So cities around the world are adding literally hundreds of kilometers of bike lanes very quickly to their cities because people are uneasy about getting in public transit in these times, and biking and walking have become extremely important. This was a moment when Toronto just got 40 kilometers of expanded bike routes done very inexpensively and very quickly. And so what does this mean? We're getting more spaces. This is an example from Calgary in Canada, where they, just by putting out cones and paint, grabbing spaces away from the car, we're adding more safe space for people to observe physical distancing in the event of COVID. And we're also quickly getting these expanded number of routes. This is from Winnipeg. So, I mean, the point is this is happening all across our country and all around the world. So I've joined forces with five organizations in Toronto. We have one called Cycle Toronto, one called Walk Toronto, something called Park People, Spacing Magazine, and the Bentway, which is a project that I've been involved in creating additional pedestrian space under an elevated highway. And you can see the website, the URL on the bottom. By the way, I'm happy to share this PowerPoint if people are interested. I can do that later. But again, this is a website. I would look up Cycle Toronto Safeways. This is happening so quickly that we've produced an app that people can have on their phones showing all this list you see in the legend of new forms of safe ways of getting around the city, which are changing almost weekly as we adapt to this time of COVID-19. And so the idea is we're moving away from this, which is not dissimilar, Nadim, from one of the images you showed, perhaps not quite as congested or chaotic, but it's the same idea, and we're trying to get to this. And this is one of the major streets in Toronto along our waterfront, which has been transformed, showing the new set of priorities: pedestrians, public transit, cyclists, and yes, there are still automobiles, but they occupy a very different place in the hierarchy. So I'm going to end with these two images, and I found this one online. This is from Karachi. And so this raises this very interesting issue for me, is to what extent can you, in your city, in your country, actually accelerate this pivot? Does everything I'm saying make sense to you? Does it fit? Does it have relevance for you? But can people make this kind of pivot in your world, avoiding a lot of the mistakes that we have made? And then my final image, and this is from Lahore, and I realize you made the point about focusing on metro lines and not buses, which is extremely important. You need the whole range of transportation devices. But clearly, you have movements in your country in the directions that I've been talking about. So that's the presentation, and I'm happy to turn it over to questions and discussion.
Thank you, Ken. That is very nice indeed. And to inform you, no, we are not quite moving away from the automobile. We have lagged behind you, but we are trying to follow the West. We are now in the range of four-leaf clovers and trying to make flyovers and underpasses everywhere. And we are trying to make these wide signal-free corridors. So those are very important things. So your presentation is very germane, and I hope that planners who are listening will get into it and ask that. But I just want to raise two or three questions with you before I turn it over to the floor. One is, you've also worked and you write a lot about this. There are a number of urban regeneration projects that you've done in Toronto. One is the Gardner thing that you were talking about, the Gardner area. There's a lot of urban regeneration that takes place in cities, New York, for example, Brooklyn, and Harlem has been rejuvenated, London East End, Chicago. I used to live on the south side of Chicago, and it's still pretty bad, but some of it has been rejuvenated. So explain to us, how does urban regeneration work and how can it play a role? Because in Pakistan, we can't seem to think of urban regeneration. We keep planning the sprawl and not think of urban regeneration. And related to that, you've mentioned two other things that I'd like you to comment on a little bit. One is your theory or your notion of subtractive urbanism. And the other is the inclusion, human-centered inclusion zoning that you talk about. All these three are kind of interlinked. So I thought I'd throw them at you.
Okay, let me tackle those in reverse order maybe. I think one of the unintended or perhaps intended, but byproducts of segregated land uses and reliance on the automobile was segregating people by class and by income. Mm-hmm. And I think we've learned that a healthy city actually has room for everyone to live together. That if, one of the ways people talk about that in North America, is, and I realize it's not as extreme as the informal sector that you're describing, where the poor live in shanty towns in Pakistani cities. But when we look at North American cities, we were seeing, for example, that in downtown Toronto, which is growing so quickly and is relatively quite prosperous, the teachers, the firemen, the police, the people who worked in grocery stores, all those people we refer to now as essential workers, couldn't live in the city. They were being pushed out into the distant suburbs in quest of affordability. And they were the ones who were being forced into these long commutes. And so the idea of mixed income neighborhoods, not only mixed in income, but mixed in age, mixed in physical abilities, mixed in family composition, has really become a rallying point. And we started to have examples of this going back, well, they go back into the early part of the 20th century, but this movement really gained momentum in Canada in the 1970s. We had a lot of cooperatives. We had mortgage funding from our Central Mortgage and Housing Agency, a federal agency, that allowed for that to happen. And they created some hugely successful neighborhoods. People liked living there. They liked the fact that they could raise their children in a safe environment, that they weren't isolated by social class, and they weren't isolated by ethnicity. They were really in a very rich and diverse environment. And so that really goes to something that we neglected that for a number of years. The funding was pulled back as part of the austerity agenda, but it's come back on the table in a very, very major way now. I'll go to the question around regeneration areas. And one of the things I've learned over the years is you have to, and for anybody on this webinar who's in a related profession to mine, you have to have bridges between broad policies, programs, and actual projects, things that get built, where you demonstrate what you're talking about, where you put the policies into practice. And almost invariably, those projects depend on, they're all P's, partnerships. And partnerships in our world, because we are in a market economy, having the development industry be partners in these neighborhood projects is extremely important. And so that was that whole array of examples that I showed you around the Golden Horseshoe that are happening. But I'll give you an example from my neighborhood. And this is a whole different way the development industry is organizing itself, recognizing what their customers, what their clients are looking for. The development industry got organized for a time around specialties. So you had developers who built office buildings, others who built shopping malls or power centers, others who built rental housing, others who built condominium housing. Each had a particularity. Now, you can't build a mixed neighborhood the way I've been describing through those silos. So two things are happening with the in the development industry. One is they're forming joint ventures where developers who have those different skills, those different abilities to get financing, who have brokerage that relates to those different types of development, are actually working together as consortia. That's one thing that's happening. The other is they're diversifying within their own companies. So as I look out the window, as I'm talking to you just down the street, there's a major project under construction and five developers representing all of those different skills and all of those different abilities to build have joined to create a mixed use neighborhood, which is seven small pedestrian oriented blocks that will have shopping, it will have a public daycare, it will have public spaces, it will have office space, it will have different types of housing, it will have everything. And so there's this kind of very interesting confluence of planning policy and marketability which is occurring. And I think what I've always looked for in all the cities that I've worked with, and half of my work has been with cities and half has been with the development industry, is places that can actually be proof of concept, where you can demonstrate the viability of these ideas by concentrated efforts.
Ken, how would you advise our prime minister who wants to build 5 million houses for the poor? Now, in cities where the land price is going through the roof, our cities, some of our cities have prices as high as Toronto, how can we possibly build 9 million houses for the poor when prices are so high? How do you have inclusionary zoning in that kind of a environment?
Well, it's a very complex issue, but I think the first thing you have to do is say, you're not just building housing, everything is connected to everything else. You have to build neighborhoods, and you have to build in employment, and you have to build in education, and you have to build in all those other aspects of life, or you're doing a disservice to the poor. And I'm going to give you an example from Mexico. Mm-hmm. Mexico has a program called Infonavit, mm-hmm. Which a portion of everybody's income tax in the whole country goes toward affordable housing. Sounds like a laudable goal. Mm-hmm. And they work with the development industry, but the form it has taken is that they are building large developments, typically on lands outside of cities, where all people of one income are living together. They're living in very small units for Mexico, and I don't know how this size compares with your standards, but the dwelling units are typically 40 square meters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there are, in many cases, multi-generational households living in these quite small units. But the problem is there's no work there. And so people, they're creating a new form of, in newer buildings, and mind you, they have plumbing and they have some basic services, but they're simply recreating the phenomenon of the shanty towns in a new form by focusing only on housing. So you could say that, you know, the goal of providing housing for people who don't have it, who don't live in solid buildings is a laudable one, but I think it's misdirected. By focusing on only one aspect of life, you're losing the opportunity. And on the other hand, you know, again, I can go to the developing world. Colombia is a great example of what they've done in Bogota and Medellin. I don't know if you're familiar with what they've done in those cities, but where they have large numbers of people living in the informal sector, and they've gone into those areas, first of all, bringing in transit in the form, because they're up on mountainsides, of cable cars and escalators and other interesting forms of transit, but also bringing in schools, libraries, other forms of employment, diversifying the neighborhoods. And that idea of the diverse land use, I think, is the key. I think if you only embark on something and you put a big housing name on it and you ignore those other aspects of life, you're only perpetuating problems.
Ken, another aspect that comes to my mind is public spaces. Now, when we've got rampant development and everybody wants to place a price on all the land that is now so called centralized, or that's become more convenient for everybody, then how do you build public spaces when there's a building boom going on? Does the state have to buy the land and do it? Does the state have to spend a lot of money doing it? Or are there more convenient and more ingenious ways of doing it?
I'm so glad you asked that question. Public space has really been the leitmotif of my whole career. And I'll say it has a very particular importance for us in Canada. I'll go back to our population. We have this population, this young population coming from all over the world, over 50% born in another country, over 50% what we call visible minorities. In fact, we have no majority population. That's basically the story. We have to get to know each other. We come from different worlds. We have different practices. We eat different foods. We have different cultures. And very, very important for us is where we can get to know each other, not just on screens and not just through the windshields of cars, but actually face to face at sidewalk level and share experiences and share public spaces. So parks, squares, active sidewalks, outdoor spaces of all kinds throughout the city have played and are playing an extraordinary role. We are seeing right now, and again, I go to COVID-19 as a particle accelerator, because we can't be safely indoors with other people. We are seeing people use every scrap of public space in our cities in a way we have never seen before. On bikes, walking, sitting with small groups of people, trying to observe physical distance. But the whole idea of the city, the outdoor spaces of the city as a shared living room for people is hugely important. I think we have to, and we are doing better at that, we have to insist when development occurs that public space, in the same way we think of schools, library, daycare, recreation centers, that public space itself and high quality public space be a part of the program. Now, again, I go back to the smart developers. The smart developers, when they want to market their neighborhoods, the first thing they do is public space. The public space becomes the calling card, becomes the park. They will build the park before they start building any buildings, because that's what they're selling. They're selling the idea that people can, with young kids, can go out and the kids have a playground to play in. And this is also very critical. How do you make spaces safe so people of different categories feel comfortable being together in public space? And every culture has its own particular form of public space with deep roots. You can't do copy paste. You can't take the kind of public spaces that might work in Spain or Italy or France or Canada or England or, you know, any Latin America and just stick them somewhere else. You have to find the cultural roots of public space in every particular society, and there are such. Where people have been used to gathering together in public space, the ways in which they've been doing it, and build from those and enhance them and reinterpret them and come up with contemporary versions.
Can you also talk about mobilizing private money to build public space in Canada?
Yep.
Or to rejuvenate certain areas? How does that work? How can we do that in Pakistan? Because out here, we rely totally on the government. No private money is available to do this. How can we do that?
So this is a relatively new thing in Canada. Mm-hmm. Our culture was pretty much is what you just described. Canadians thought we pay our taxes. We expect to get public services from the government. Why should anybody else get involved? And I think what we have seen is that governments are cash strapped. They haven't been able to do all the things we would like to do. So there's a whole new form of philanthropy and corporate sponsorship, which is coming into play in the realm of public space. So the project called the Bentway, which I wrote about in Toronto Reborn, and again, it's another site you can Google, Bentway, Bentway, came about as a private donation from a couple of philanthropists who, rather than doing what most of their cohorts might have done, which is to donate a hospital wing or a university faculty or a museum collection, their interest was public space. And they had some successes with that. And they were attracted to a project that I had identified and ended up making a $25 million donation to create this space. And that is being replicated more and more, but the obligation didn't end there. With their donation, we were able to approach the city and say to the city, to the mayor and to the city councilors, all right, we're putting a capital donation on the table. You have to match that with an ongoing donation for programming, operation, and maintenance over time. And then we will commit ourselves to additional philanthropy and corporate sponsorships. And there also is a whole emerging idea of nonprofit boards, conservancies, we call them, for the management of special public spaces. And again, I think having demonstration projects, having places that are special, that demonstrate the viability of these ideas is really important. And once you can do that, they start to attract other people into the field.
Can you mention smart public space? Can you define what a smart public space is? How should we think about it? Because normally we think of public space as just a grassy patch called a park. What is a smart public space?
Well, I think it's, the term is used to mean many different things. But for me, I think one of the exciting things of our time is the ways in which we can use technology to support what I would call a human-centered urbanism, mm-hmm. based on human beings. So what I fear, what I worry about sometimes, is that we will get so lost in our screens and in virtual communication with each other that we'll lose the face-to-face, we'll lose the on-the-ground human connections. However, if you think of public spaces and you think of ways of monitoring traffic and dealing with signalization for traffic that is more sophisticated, if you think of bike share and car share and ways of accessing different forms of public transit, if you think of microclimate and ways in which we can attenuate, in our case, we're a winter country. So we have to think about shelter from wind, melting snow on sidewalks, using waste heat to deal with snow and ice. There's so many ways in which technology can be employed, hence the smartness, to enhance the human experience. And I think, you know, I love working with young people who are much more adept at the technology than I am, and all the interesting ideas that they bring, especially artists. Artists now, so many of them are working with technology. So one of the things that the Bentway is doing in the time of COVID is we have teamed up with a company that is in the public relations advertising business, and we've gotten free access to digital screens all around the city and are commissioning artworks meant to be inspirational to people in this time of COVID, sending positive messages to people all around the city. So that's a use of technology in public space that would have been unimaginable before.
Great. I must turn it over to my friends now, because obviously many people are waiting to ask you a question. But just before I do that, can you, both you and your wife, just say a few words about Jane Jacobs, her importance, and what you, because you knew her very well, what's your take on Jane Jacobs and how she impacted urbanism and urban thinking? You know, something on that, on those lines, if you can.
Okay. I arrived in Toronto within a few months of Jane Jacobs' arrival, and I was a student at university, and I had read her great book, which I, one of many books, but perhaps the one that's best known, Death and Life of Great American Cities. And I summoned up my courage and I called her and I asked her to give me a critique of my student project at the School of Architecture. And she was gracious enough to do that, which was extraordinary. And that began a lifelong friendship until her death in 2006. And she was my mentor all through that time. My wife and I have been together for 21 years. She became a close friend of both of ours. My stepdaughter was actually her bookseller. She procured all the books that Jane was using in her research. She was a frequent guest in our home for dinner. She was an amazing source of inspiration. She was unpredictable. No one could pin her down on a left-right political spectrum. She believed very strongly in the role of the public sector as well as in the role of the entrepreneurial sector. But what most distinguished her was she was a keen observer. She went from observation. And the way she got into the urban field, and I'll just finish with this, she married an architect. She was writing for an architectural journal. She, as a young woman, she moved to New York with her sister. She loved to roam the city and look constantly at what was going on, just immense curiosity. And so she started writing for this architectural journal about all these urban renewal projects that were what people thought was the right thing to do. And she began to see them failing and failing disastrously. And that is what propelled her to write Death and Life. And so she went back trusting her eyes to an attempt to get to first principles. And the final thing I'll say is where planners and engineers and architects and landscape architects saw chaos, she saw a kind of order. She took a concept from biological sciences called organized complexity, which we now think of as ecology, where there's a different kind of relationship than the linear relationships that people think of in engineering terms. And she saw that order in the city. And she was able to produce an astonishing array of research, which has touched economists, touched people in physical sciences and biological sciences, certainly in the planning and design fields through those intense observations through all of her work. And I regard her perhaps as the single greatest influence in my life.
Oh, great. Would Mrs. Greenberg like to add anything on that? Or
Etty, I don't know if you know how to click on unmute yourself. She's unable to do it. She's on another screen. But we both had a wonderful relationship.
Well, you're speaking to somebody who really learned his urbanism from her, because one of my professors started working with her, talking about her, citing her, the Nobel Prize winner for 96, Robert Lucas. So that's how we economists discovered Jane Jacobs and got into it. But in any case, now I think we'll go to the floor. So let me give it to Babar Khan. Babar Khan, sir? Babar Khan? Babar Khan, sir? Ji, go ahead. Babar, are you speaking or not? Like, we can't hear you. I don't think we can hear Babar. Zia Bande then. Zia Bande. Zia Bande.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Zia, go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Greenberg, thank you very much for this learning presentation of yours. My question is simple. I'm basically interested in the local economic development side. I need to understand the politics of this urban development which went in Toronto. I mean to say, you are a federation. I just need to understand that what was the role of the city government, what was the role of the provincial government, and what was the role of the federal government. And if you basically segregate the contribution to how much percentage this city government and provincial and federal government contributed towards the urban development of Toronto. Thank you.
Okay, that's a great question. We have a very complex system of governance. As you said, we have a federal government, which has certain overall programs and authorities. We have a provincial government, and we're a very decentralized country. So the provinces, in our case, Ontario, have great powers for transportation, education, urban development. We also have regional governments, and then we have municipal governments. So in a sense, we have four tiers. It is complicated to get the four tiers to collaborate, and occasionally they do. But I'm gonna work my way up from the bottom in some of the things I've been talking about. And I'll add to the tiers of government, the community interaction with municipal decision-making. So the beginning of the paradigm shift that occurred in Toronto, what really happened in the late 1960s and early 1970s, when there was a groundswell of skepticism around the kind of policies that were being implemented, exactly Nadim, what you were describing, building more highways, segregating land uses, ripping up older transportation systems, and particularly almost using the United States as a kind of laboratory, looking across the border at what was happening to US cities, which were in chaos. And so the people of Toronto, it began with citizens' movements who, in the course of several municipal elections, elected what was called a reform council. And the reform council dedicated itself to charting a different future for the city of Toronto. The then collaboration, and I'm just using a specific example to illustrate the point. The province, the provincial government, which was the next level of government up, we had a regional government, but the province became significant because the premier of the province, the leader of our provincial government, played an incredibly instrumental role at a key point in this whole story, where we were poised to build the next major urban highway that would have run right through the heart of the city, demolishing neighborhoods and doing all the things that they were doing in US cities. And the premier, his name was Bill Davis, stood up in the provincial parliament and he said, if you want to build a city for cars, you should build this highway. But if you want to build a city for people, this is the place to stop. And that was I think that was about 1972. That was the pivotal moment. And that's when the provincial government came on side in significant ways. Then in Ottawa, our federal government became very significant through the organization I mentioned to you before, Canada Mortgage and Housing, which was financing development and financing housing. And they got into the act in terms of enabling a lot of these forms of development that I was talking about to occur. So I am constantly in all my work, in the work that I'm doing in that city called Brampton, which I mentioned to you, one of the things we're doing now in real time is trying to align the city council with the provincial members of parliament, with the federal members of parliament, with the school boards, with the library boards, getting all these groups to align around common objectives. It takes a lot of energy. I won't deny it. But for these things to be successful, they have to be both bottom up and top down. They can't simply be imposed from the top. And if you don't have collaboration from the top, you can't do it only from bottom up.
Ken, one question. How do you view master planning? Master planning is something that we have been taught by city planners, chiefly people like Doxiadis. I don't know whether you know him or not. He was very big in Pakistan. He planned a city, a new capital called Islamabad. But we are building master plans for every city. And then the problem with the master plans is they kind of get frozen in time. And eventually we get into court cases and encroachment issues and all kinds. So how do you view master planning? How should master planning be done for cities?
So some years ago, I stopped using the term master planning. Mm-hmm. And I instead use the word framework. Mm-hmm. And it's not just semantics. The difference is many master plans or people who think about master planning had the illusion that they could look out over decades and be highly predictive of an end state. Mm-hmm. And then simply say, we will implement the plan in phases. And if you go back to the concept of organized complexity, the ecological analogy that I've used, what you're really doing with the framework is it's rooted in principles, it's rooted in relationships, but it's designed to have a high degree of flexibility, mm-hmm. and to allow for unpredictable things to happen, allow for improvisation. And what you're really talking about, and this is a hard thing for some people to grasp, your aim, it's like a sailor in a sailboat where you have to be guided by the winds as opposed to being in a powerboat where you can just set a course and you go straight in whatever direction you want to go. You have to tack. You have to allow yourself to respond to unforeseen circumstances, to changes in economic cycles, to changes in demographics. And over the course of decades, which is really the meaningful time frame for such frameworks, inevitably many things happen. So a famous example for me is I worked for the city of St. Paul, Minnesota. I did a framework for them, such a framework, and it was one of my first examples of learning how to do that in 1997. That framework, 23 years later, is still, through the lenses of that framework, are still being used five mayors later, five administrations later, multiple state governments later, to guide development, because the framework is sufficiently flexible and malleable to account for and allow for changes. That doesn't mean it's a free-for-all, because the principles of key relationships are very clear.
We have lots of people. Let me see here, there's somebody here. Alia Khan. Alia, go ahead. Alia?
Yes, I'm speaking. Thank you very much for a very, very exciting and inspiring presentation. My question is that while I was looking at the slides, I felt as if the environmental concerns were very carefully being taken care of. For example, the change in the transportation, modes of transportation, and the open spaces being made available for people. Was that a conscious decision in terms of a partnership that, you know, for a more green city, you need to think of how to change and control carbon emissions? Because in Pakistan, there's a lot of emphasis on planting trees for combating climate change, but not really on the way the whole transportation system works. So I'd like your comments on that. Thank you very much.
Appreciate the question. The table of people that I work with has enlarged in a really positive way. So to the planners, economists, architects, landscape architects, engineers, people in the development industry, economic development people that may have been traditionally around the table, there are several new, very important voices. A whole area of environmental sustainability, ecologists, environmental engineers, people who really understand the science of environment, air, land, water, all of the impacts are at the table with us in every project. A second group of people, which is relatively recent and extremely important, are the medical profession, public health officials, for all the reasons that I was talking about, who are now having a powerful voice at planning tables. And the third is what I would call people who deal with community infrastructure. And so this is a whole array of things, from schools, libraries, community centers, daycare, seniors facilities, all of these social equipment that makes neighborhoods sustainable. And I think one of the great lessons is all those things don't exist in separate spheres. They're all highly interactive and highly connected. And the only way you can really appreciate those connections is by having all those people participate directly in the discussion. And it's incredibly enlightening. It leads to all kinds of interesting lateral solutions, where when you're trying to solve a problem, you may find that the solution resides in a completely different area outside your discipline.
Atif Aslam? Atif Aslam Tab? Atif, can you hear me?
Sorry, I have to, okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much, Greenberg. I just have one question for you. How you see the future of mass public transport system in the post-COVID world?
This is something that is being highly discussed now. Right now is devastating. In Toronto, and in cities in the Western world, I would say generally the sub-transit took a nosedive. It really, people were just afraid, justifiably so. So we're now in an interim period when people are trying to observe social distance, when our transit authority is starting to pick up again, people are used to it. However, in the long term, I think we will end up still relying on transit to a very significant extent. I think it will be somewhat different. I think we'll see some improvements perhaps to the overcrowding that we've experienced in transit. But one of the key concepts that's emerged is the idea of redundancy. That in the event of any kind of, whether it's a natural disaster or a virus or any other thing that comes along, we have to have multiple ways of doing things. We have to be able to pivot from one way of doing things to another. And so what, you know, I go back to the all these emerging bike lanes that have appeared in Toronto, they are running along the subway lines. So interestingly enough, for people who feel uncomfortable about being in the subways, which has the effect of thinning out the subways, we now have thousands of people biking where they would have been on the subway. So it's a sensitive issue. I think it has affected all of our planning. But I have to say that the provincial government's commitment to the $60 billion investment in transit infrastructure remains undiminished, preparing for this post-COVID period.
And one last question. We seem to be stuck on rigid zoning still. How are you people in the West now in advanced cities seeing zoning, A? And B, also, we seem to be stuck with buildings having mandatory parking requirements. So if you build, for example, the new law says that for every 1,500 square foot of space that is built up, the builder has to provide one car park space. So, I mean, this is something that we are stuck with. At the same time, we're also stuck with this thing that we tend to have building by building building laws. Like, for example, height restrictions, setbacks, etc. How do you manage this? Is it area-wise restrictions or building-wise restrictions? So, I mean, just a general comment on this.
Yeah, there are a number of things in your question. If you go back to the origins of zoning, it was designed to tell you what you could not do. And by elimination, you would get to what you were allowed to do. It was also meant to separate things into very discrete categories. So zoning has evolved in to become, as the way we're using it now, to do almost the opposite of those original intentions. More and more of our zoning is about mix as opposed to exclusion. So when it comes to land use, it's urging people to combine things rather than separate them, combining living and working, combining all kinds of different uses, subject, of course, to eliminating things that are truly toxic or damaging to people's health. So the first thing is we're moving to mix. The second thing is we're moving significantly to zoning, not by individual buildings, but by neighborhood clusters. So we have what are called small area plans. We have planned urban development, planned development areas, which look at a whole neighborhood together rather than one building at a time, and really looks at the relationships between buildings. Thirdly, we're moving more and more away from highly prescriptive profiles for buildings with specified setbacks, where the zoning is trying to design the building for the architect, rather to creating the desirable qualities or characteristics from a performance standpoint, and then relying on the interpretation by skilled people, often design review panels at the municipal level, who will interpret how well the architects are succeeding in meeting the performance criteria. Lastly, with respect to parking, parking is turning out to be a moving target. As the world is changing, the parking standards are plummeting. And so we now, in the city of Toronto, we went from multiple parking spaces per dwelling unit to one parking space for four dwelling units, because people are not owning cars for the reasons that I described, that we were building parking that was sitting empty. And in many cases, we're really letting the market evolve and bring a kind of dynamic decision-making into the whole parking issue. I've participated in discussions with developers who are really worried about all this parking that they were forced to build previously that no one wants. No one wants to rent it, no one wants to buy it, no one wants to use it. And so what do? Grow mushrooms? I mean, this is, so to the extent that parking is being built now, a lot of it is being built so that ultimately it can be converted to other uses. And what does that mean? It means not building ramp floors, it means building higher floor to ceiling spaces, and it means designing whatever multi-story parking you're doing so that it can be converted to buildings that will serve other uses in the future.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ken, if you have the time, I'll take 1 minute. There's somebody else has raised their hand. Let me take their question. Khurram Farid.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Ken Greenberg, it's very nice to hear from you today.
Let me, Khurram, just one. Let me also say.
Yes. The thing yes. is, Khurram, I just need Khurram to also know. The, I have one question.
Go ahead, Khurram.
Okay, I have just one question. In post-COVID-19, there is a paradigm shift in planning standards. Obviously, we, as you said in very start of your discussion, that COVID is not going away very soon. So all the planning standards which we have been, which we have derived over the period of centuries, those are going to keep social distance even in the parks and other shopping centers. How we are going to incorporate and how do you see planning in next 15 to 20 years? If the vaccine is there, obviously the scenario will be different, but we have to observe such paradigm shift in planning our cities.
Yes,
and one more question.
Yeah, let me introduce as Dr. well. Town planners in Pakistan. Go ahead, Khurram.
Yes, one more question. Dr. Nadeem was saying that master plan does not exist and that's an obsolete document at the moment. But somehow Toronto has its two plans, not just a framework. It's an official plan of Toronto, and also there's another plan for Toronto City as well. So there are different plans for each and every city. We can change the name, we can have a different nomenclature. How do you see if the city does not have any plan or any framework in place, how the growth will happen to that city and how that will going to be shaped up?
Okay, let me talk about the shopping centers first. As I said, COVID-19 is a particle accelerator and is pushing things to happen faster that were happening anyway. So as we have been opening up, the regulations have been devised so that those commercial establishments that can serve people outdoors on the sidewalk were allowed to do what they call curbside pickup because people didn't have to go indoors. So when it came to malls, if you had to go indoors, they were not allowed to open. And at malls, the only places that did open were the ones that had doors to the outside, to the street. So that turned out to be a very interesting thing, that suddenly it was a huge disadvantage to be working off an enclosed interior space. Now, what's happening with the malls and what's happening anyway, and I think will happen even more quickly, is that many of the major developers who built and owned those malls were in the process of demolishing them to build mixed-use neighborhoods. Why? Because online shopping was taking away their market. For people who were just looking for a price point for cheap goods, they could do it more easily with Amazon online than going to the mall. What they were looking for was rather the shopping experience. And the shopping experience was in the neighborhood shopping streets, not to be found in the mall. So that phenomenon, I think, is being accelerated. And some of the biggest shopping center developers are actually the most active participants there. With respect to the planning regulations that you mentioned, we have in the province of Ontario, every municipality has to have what are called official plans. Some other jurisdictions call them comprehensive plans, and we have zoning bylaws. And those are the typical instruments of planning. They have to be maintained by the cities. The official plans themselves, what they're dealing with, are increasingly changing to become visionary documents, which in the spirit that I was describing before, speak to the kind of future that the city is aiming for in terms of environmental sustainability, social sustainability, a shift in mobility. It's sort of broad ideas about how to bring about change, not quantified and not highly specific, but only in a very general way. So they've become more like the frameworks that I was describing. The same is for the zoning bylaws. The zoning bylaws have become much more about mix and flexibility than they have been about the highly prescriptive. So even within those prescribed documents that cities have to maintain, the changes that I was talking about in focus or in emphasis are observable.
Thank you very much, Ken. Thank you. This was a great, very illuminating talk. Really appreciate it. And I must give a big shout out to Zoya Ali, who's associated with PIHE. She's a research associate. Zoya volunteered, got in touch with you, and helped me arrange this with you. So I'm deeply thankful to Zoya. So Zoya, please show yourself so that we can all thank you. But at the same time, Ken, you've done a great job, a wonderful job, and really enjoyed all this information from you. And we'll be in touch. Inshallah, keep in touch with you a lot more.
So, Nadeem, let me thank all of you. It truly has been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed this, and Zoya as well for making the contact. And I wish you every success in all your endeavors in Pakistan.
It's COVID over. We will, inshallah, get you to Pakistan.
Okay. Inshallah.
Thank you. All the best, guys.
Thank you.
All the best to your wife. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.